Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk about the Kingdom of God. Today we're going to talk specifically about covenants, what they are, what their limitations are, and how they relate both to man and to God, and also how they relate from man and man. Can man make covenants with men? Well, of course they can. Throughout the Bible, they talk about covenants some 300 times. They don't always translate the word in the Hebrew into covenants. Sometimes they translate it into other words, such as league. But basically, a covenant is an agreement. It may be made between God and man, or man and man. Generally speaking, we use the word today, covenant, which is not the original word, of course. And we think of covenants as specifically agreements only between God and man. In the WorldNet dictionary put out by the Princeton University, they actually define in their second definition concerning the noun covenant as a reference to Bible, an agreement between God and his people in which God makes certain promises and requires certain behavior from them in return. Now that is not an incorrect definition, but that is a limiting definition that we should not limit ourselves to when we think of the terms covenants, because clearly the Bible does talk about covenants between men and men, not simply between man and God. They also say that a covenant is a signed written agreement between two or more parties or nations to perform some action. Its synonyms would be words like compact or concordant. One could even say that there are aspects of a covenant in a constitution. A compact is simply an agreement. That's all it is. There may be lots of different agreements, but what's interesting about the agreement is that in a compact, two people are compacted. That's why the word is compact. They are brought together. You may agree with me, I may agree with you, but we have no compact. We just happen to both agree. But this idea of a compact includes at least one other element other than the fact that we both have the same opinion. The same is true of a covenant, same is true of a contract or a concordant. Concordant was another one of these synonyms. As we use the word concordant today, it's a signed written agreement between two or more parties or nations to perform some action. Again, that's almost identical to the definition of a covenant, as we saw up there in the Princeton University. But it specifically goes on to say that a pope, who is the head of a government, often signs an agreement with other governments, and they call that agreement a concordant. That's just simply modern usage. These words come from different sources, and we have a tendency to use a concordant in that sense, but basically what a concordant is several people or nations are coming into accord. They're making an agreement. They are coming into an agreement. So what is an agreement? An agreement is the act of agreeing, but a contract is more than an act of agreeing. So is a covenant more than just the act of agreeing. Like I said, I can agree with you and you agree with me, but we don't have a covenant. In law, a properly executed and legally binding contract, the writing of a document embodying this contract, that's what they call an agreement. Well, if you limit that definition of agreement to the law, it sounds just like a contract. It says it's a binding contract. It's the body of the terms of a contract. That's what an agreement is. So an agreement, yes, can be a contract, or we can be in agreement but not have a contract. There has to be a binding, that compacting, that concordant, that covenant to make something an actual contract or compact. Something has to exchange between the parties to obligate them. If we go up to the American Heritage Dictionary and we take a look at their definition of a covenant is a binding agreement, a compact. So there they are. They're telling you a compact is a covenant. A covenant is a compact. It's a binding agreement. It's not just that you agree, but somehow or other you are bound in that agreement. The same dictionary goes on in the concept of law. It says that a covenant is a formal sealed agreement or contract. Well, how do you seal it? Is that just that little wax thing and you press your seal into it? No, it's more than just putting a seal on it. Somehow or other, you have to seal that covenant. There has to be an exchange. Something has to be given up. Something has to be received. And that is this exchange, this lawful exchange, is what seals the agreement. You have begun to fulfill that agreement so that it is now binding. Because if you have accepted something based on the terms of that agreement and you don't keep the agreement, then the thing that you have accepted is stolen and you are a thief. And being a thief is a fundamental violation of law. It's back up to the Ten Commandments, the basic concept. Something you have taken which is not yours. It was yours as long as you agreed, but as soon as you stop fulfilling the terms of that agreement, what you took is now thievery, and you have to give it back, all of it back. And you may have to give it back with penalties and interest, depending on the nature of the agreement, the terms of the agreement. So, what is a constitution? Is a constitution an agreement? Well, of course it is. Is it a contract also? Well, one definition says that a constitution is the act or process of composing, setting up, or establishing. Okay, so a constitution doesn't just mean that there's an agreement. It's a particular kind of agreement. It's one that establishes something. It sets up something. It's a process of composing something. The system of fundamental laws and principles that prescribes the nature, function, and limits of a government or another institution. So it's not just a government, but some other institution. That's what a constitution is doing. It's describing those principles, the basic nature and the function and the limits of that institution or government. The document itself can be called the constitution in which such a system is recorded. John Campbell, in 1857, he wrote, talking about the U.S. Constitution, in his opinion in Dred Scott, he asserted that the claim that the Constitution was a compact amongst the states. So he says that the Constitution was a compact, and there's a great debate. Is it a compact? Is it a contract? What is the Constitution? Well, when it was first written out, it was just so many words on a piece of paper. It was not sealed into an agreement. When it said we the people up there, almost none of the people even knew about it. So you had to do something extra to bring this piece of paper and these words on it into a real constitution. Now, it was a constitution in the sense that the process had begun. Somebody hacked out the terms of the agreement. But it wasn't yet fulfilled. It wasn't ratified. There was no agreement between the people of America and each other or the states or whatever that this piece of paper had any authority in law. As a matter of fact, the terms we the people at the top of the page only referred to those people who signed the agreement. The people who put their John Hancock on there, that Thomas Jefferson and the rest of them, the ones who agreed to this document were we the people. There was no other people involved in this at that time. The states had never given these men any authority to create this document other than the authority they had as individuals. And as individuals, they agreed that this was going to be the Constitution, which, again, is this process of composing, setting up, or establishing. So the document is actually a process. I mean, not just the document. The document is a piece of paper, but the Constitution is actually a process. And we see that process beginning when those men signed that agreement. We, the people of the United States, they formed an actual corporate body by their signatures. It couldn't do all the things that it says to do in the Constitution yet because they were the only ones who agreed to it. They had to get other people to agree to it. And it was clearly written to get the agreement of the state governments. And it was brought to them and asked them to agree. And there was a great debate over whether they would agree. Now, John Campbell, like I said that this Constitution was a compact. Well, when it was signed, it wasn't a compact because the states had not yet agreed to it. They had not formed that compact. That was where they were going with it, and this was all part of that process. Chief Justice Jay asserts that every state constitution is a compact made by and between the citizens of the state to govern themselves in a certain manner, and the Constitution of the United States is likewise a compact made by the people of the United States to govern themselves as to general objects in certain manner. Okay, well, who are the people of the United States? Well, until that Constitution was written, there was no United States as an entity. There was no people of the United States. The only people, again, when it was signed, were the people who signed it. That was we, the people. They were the ones. So is the Constitution a compact? Is it something else? Is it a contract? Well, Robert Greenslade said the Constitution was a compact, a contract between the individual states before the Civil War, and it remained a compact or contract between the individual states after the war. He also said the federal government was not a party to the constitutional compact between the several states before the Civil War, and it did not become a party to that compact after the war. Now, he just said that the federal government was not a party to the Constitution. Well, it wasn't a party to the agreement when the agreement was the first agreed to, because it was the agreement that created the Constitution, which was a fictional entity created by this agreement. These men came together and created this body called the United States, that all the rights, powers, and authorities of the United States hinged upon this paper. It did not exist as a government until somebody wrote it out and established it by signing it. It had almost no power, no more power than all those men put together had when it was first signed. But when they brought it to the states, some powers were actually vested in it that were of considerable influence.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.
So why are we talking so much about this concept of constitutions? Shouldn't we be talking about the Bible? The word constitution doesn't show up in the Bible. Well, actually, in the original Bible, the word covenant doesn't show up either. That's the term we apply to a particular Hebrew word, which means an agreement. And the Bible clearly has to do with governments. Abraham left the government of Haran and went out and formed these altars, which substituted as government. Moses took the people out of the government of Egypt and set up a thing called the Kingdom of God, or Israel, which was a government. Jesus came preaching a kingdom and told us not to be like the governments of the Gentiles who exercise authority one over the other. There's actually even a written constitution in the Bible. We're told to write it out. The terms of that constitution are spelled out in the Bible in the Old Testament, and that we are to keep those. And if we ever have a leader, he is to read those terms every day. And the priests, the ministers of that kingdom of Israel, was to see to it that he read the terms of that agreement, that constitution, so that he did not violate it. And that's very clearly spelled out in the Bible. But a constitution is a contract. That's what Greenslade was asking. Is it a contract or a compact? He wasn't questioning whether it was. He was talking about who was a party to it and who was not a party to it. But it definitely is at least a contract. It is also a compact. It is clearly an agreement. It has terms. It has limitations. And it grants power. It is sealed. And it is binding. So it is, but it is a specifically type of agreement. And we today use the term constitution. But it is a covenant. It is a contract. Exodus 23:32 tells us, "Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods." So now what did they just say there? I read that rather rapidly to give you a chance to hear it. You've probably all heard it before. But now let's read it slowly and hear what it actually is telling us. And make note of the ideas that the author is trying to impart to you. "Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods." So it's clear that you could make a covenant with them, the people, and you could make a covenant with their gods, with whom the Lord had made a covenant and charged them, saying, "Ye shall not fear other gods, nor bow yourself down to them, nor serve them, nor sacrifice to them." Well, what is this sacrifice to them? Well, we'll have to get into that, but I want you to make note of that, that you're not to serve these other gods, you're not to sacrifice to them, you're not to bow down to them, and you shouldn't fear them. Very important not to fear these other gods, because by fearing something, you give it power, and by bowing down to something, you give it power. By serving it, you give it power. By sacrificing to it, you give it power. And all power and glory belong to God, God the Father. You should not be giving it to others. Now that was in 2 Kings 17:35, but if we go back to Exodus again, 34:12, we say, "Take heed to thyself, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land whether thou goest, lest it be for a snare in the midst of thee." Now that's a very important word. I want you to note that too. Snare in the midst of thee. He's talking, take heed to thyself. He's telling you to be careful, be cautious, lest ye make a covenant. Well, could you make a covenant by accident? Could you make a covenant without realizing exactly what you're doing? Well, yes, you could actually make a covenant without realizing what you're doing. But you say, well, how can I come into an agreement if I don't even know I'm agreeing? Well, there is a way in which you can come into an agreement without really knowing that you're coming into an agreement. It's not a complete trap. In other words, the terms are not necessarily in your conscious mind, but you know enough about the terms, and your actions seal your deeds into your agreement, so to speak, by your deeds. And you have made what they call a constructive contract. Now, some people say, I don't have to obey constructive contracts. If you sealed the agreement by accepting something, by eating the bait, so to speak, then you become obligated under certain conditions. Yes, there are conditions to constructive contracts. Every time you are not necessarily bound by it, but you can become trapped in an agreement, a covenant, a contract, without actually consciously reading all the fine print and terms. If you neglect and don't take heed, you may do just that. Several times in the Old Testament and the New Testament, they warn about us being trapped, about us being snared. And what do they usually talk about in relationship to that trap or snare? They talk about eating at the table of rulers. Yes, that could become a snare to you. That could become a trap to you. That could become a stumbling block to you. So, who are rulers? Rulers are them that you're not to be making contracts with. So we know we shouldn't overtly make contracts and agreements with them where we go, nor with their gods. But we also know that we can actually be trapped into making these, snared into making these agreements where we become bound because of particular activities. And why is that? That's because consent makes the law. And you can give your consent in many ways. Even acquiescing can give consent. You don't always have to shout it at the rooftops that you agree. You can do it through your actions, through your deeds, through inaction. You can give consent and acquiesce and create a contract through a number of different factors, but you can do it without sitting down with, you know, a 12-page contract where you sign in triplicate and get it notarized. You can create contracts many different ways. In Matthew 5:34-37, we hear Jesus talking, "But I say unto you, swear not at all," he says. That's very important to understand, for whatsoever is more than yes or no cometh of evil. So if you're asked something and you say yes, that's maybe okay. If you say no, that's maybe okay. But if you say more, "I swear, I solemnly swear, I solemnly affirm, I swear under penalty of perjury," that may cometh of evil because you're making an agreement. And what's an agreement? It's a covenant. It's a compact. It's a contract. And there are terms. What are you agreeing to? Have you read all the terms? No, you probably haven't. Are you completely familiar with all the terms? Probably not. But yet people make these agreements. They swear. And Jesus specifically told us not to do so. That seems pretty authoritarian advice. We should really listen to that. And if we are Christians, we should be hanging on his every word. So if you're participating in any institution or government that is requiring you to swear to this, that, or the other thing, that may very well cometh of evil. And Christ has warned you not to do that. Even in James, which is also in the Bible, 5:12, it says, "But above all things," he says, "my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath." Why? Lest ye fall into condemnation. Over 300 times in the Bible, they talk about covenants, which is talking about contracts, talking about agreements. There are actually even more times than that where they talk about agreements. Paul says, you know, "What agreement do you have?" He's bringing up this idea of covenants, contracts, and agreements in the New Testament, warning you against them. Christ is warning you against binding yourselves with oaths. James is doing the same thing. I don't hear enough ministers who claim to be preachers of the gospel warning the people not to take these oaths. It is simply not taught in the seminaries today. Somewhere along the line, I mean, men were dying. Men were persecuted. Men were executed. Men were in prison because they wouldn't take oaths. And of course, no oath is valid unless it's done voluntarily. But still, because men would not take oaths based upon these religious convictions that come from reading the words and understanding the words of Christ, that went on for years, centuries. And now Christians take an oath at the drop of a hat. They're swearing left and right, right and left, at almost anything, and think nothing of it. And why is that? Well, personally, I think it's because the preachers are not preaching the whole gospel. They leave off the statements of Jesus that are inconvenient to preach. Well, the definition of a lie is simply not all of the truth. Even the word truth, as we see it in the New Testament, when Jesus says, "I am the way, the life, and the truth," there's half a dozen different words that could be there in the Greek, but that particular word means the whole truth. So we need to always be trying to preach the whole truth of the gospel. In 2 Kings 17:15, we see, "And they rejected his statutes and his covenants that he made with their fathers, and his testimony which is testified against them, and they followed vanity, became vain, and went after the heathen that were round about them, whom the Lord had charged them, and they should not do like them." The Lord said they should not be like the heathens. They were told not to be that way. And Jesus said the same thing. "You have seen the princes of the Gentiles who exercise authority," he says. It is not to be that way with you. It's not to be so with you. So Jesus didn't change anything when he said that. He ratified that. He emphasized that with a statement again that we are seldom read to out of the Bible by modern ministers. Even though it's repeated in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and in precepts, you hear it in John over and over again, and even Paul says it. But instead, they take little sections of the Bible and they say, oh, I hold this up, and they say, oh, yeah, but we have to do this. Oh, yes, and we have to do that. And we'll take you to those one by one, and we'll deal with the image that they have created in your minds as to what the gospel is. And we're iconoclasts. We smash those images. We don't smash it with violence. We don't smash it with screaming at you. We smash it with the truth. Now, we see this as the gospel now. We can clearly see it. But now we have to share what we see with you. We have to paint a picture for you of what we see. And that's a process. And that takes a lot of energy and time, a lot of prayer to know exactly how do we describe this whole picture of the gospel when everyone is fixated on this little picture of the gospel. And I'm sure you all want the whole picture of the gospel. I mean, it's like, I only want to see Jesus's foot. Well, you don't want to just see his foot. You want to have a relationship with all of Jesus, the whole armor of God. You want the whole enchilada. You want the truth, don't you? And that's what we want to deal with. We don't want you to be snared into a small concept of the gospel. We want you to have the fullness of the gospel, to understand the whole of that truth. In Malachi, we see, who shall we seek to know the truth? For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth. For he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. That's what the ministers of God should be. But ye are departed out of the way, he says. Ye have caused many to stumble at the law. Ye have corrupted the covenant of the Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore have I also made you contemptible and base before all the people according, as ye have not kept my ways, but have partial in the law. In other words, not the whole truth, only a little bit of it. A form of godliness, but deny the power thereof. You're just not taking in the whole gospel, and you're missing a huge, important aspect of the gospel that will bring you closer and closer to that divine presence, which will be manifested in your hearts and your minds as you receive the truth of the gospel. Not from me. I'll talk about it, but you get it from the Lord when you accept the truth of the Lord, which I can only refer to in a very humble, meager way with words and language, and hopefully by actions and deeds. Have we not all one Father? Well, do we all have one Father? Hath not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously every man against his brother by profaning the covenant of our fathers? Well, how do we deal treacherously every man with his brother and profane the covenant of our fathers? Well, we covet our neighbor's goods. If we covet our neighbor's goods in any way, shape, or form, we are dealing treacherously and we are profaning that covenant with our father. And Christ said the same thing. And Peter warned us, through covetousness they shall make merchandise of you. So in talking about the concept of constitutions, covenants, contracts, compacts, even leagues or treaties, we see that they all are the same order of the same thing. They have a way of binding people under a consensual created law. You agree with this man, I agree that you can make agreements for me, then he goes out and makes agreements. You are bound by his agreements. That's what God is trying to keep you from doing, where you don't have whole nations who grant to one man or 10 men or 385 men the power to make agreements for you, to bind you, to bind your children, to be under the authority of the judges, that one man has the power, or that one group of men, that one body has the power to create for you. You are giving God-given authority, God-given rights that you have to make choices to someone, and he now can exercise authority one over the other, and that is very dangerous because you've given him power, and power will corrupt him. Very few men are not corrupted by even the smallest amount of power. Christ received all power and was not corrupted. Moses had power and he was corrupted. He did things wrong. He exercised authority. He hit the rock more than once. He used his rod to force an issue. And that precept is not for the ministers of God's kingdom. They cannot force the issue. They must leave the power in the hands of the Holy Spirit. They are peacemakers, but that is because they give power where it belongs. They say, not by me, but by my Father in heaven. Not by us, but by our Father in heaven. That's how the ministers of God's kingdom operate. That's not the way most governments operate. They operate by force, by control, and by power. They have their constitutions that try to limit those powers, but in the Bible they tell us that if we do create a government where the individuals or the leaders have power, we should very carefully write down the limitations of that power and keep that man under the authority of that written agreement by making him read it every day and by having priests who see to it that he reads it and sticks to those rules that he is bound by. And those rules are called a constitution. In Judges 2:2, we see, "And he shall make no league with the inhabitants of this land." With the inhabitants. And again, that word league is the same word that we see translated into covenant, because it is the same word. We should make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land. So that means we can't have any contracts with people who live around us? Well, obviously we can make some sort of agreements. Trade agreements. You know, I'll give you my cow if you give me your horse. That's an agreement. But generally speaking, we're not to be making agreements that would bind us to continuous service. If you take care of me in my old age, I will pay you so much every year. That's a different kind of agreement. That binds you, that you now are obligated to pay him so much every year. And if you say, for instance, if you educate my children, I will guarantee that I will give you a percentage of everything I earn. Now he goes and educates your children, you have to continue to give a percentage of everything you earn. And so there are leagues, agreements that continue on. It was very important in the common law that if you made an agreement, a sale, I'm going to sell you my cow, I'm going to sell you my sheep, and you're going to give me 10 silver dollars. I give you the sheep, you give me the 10 silver dollars, the sun sets, the deal's done. I mean, it's done. There's no ongoing. All deals were done in one day. Now, there was a way in which you could say, well, I will work for you for 7 years, and you will give me this piece of property. At the end of the 7 years, he had to give you that piece of property. And of course, we see that in the Bible where, you know, we've got Jacob working for 7 years for Rachel and ended up getting Leah. And then he had to work another 7 years to get Rachel. And then another 7 years to get some cattle and sheep. And those were deals, 7-year contracts. That 7 years is still found today in law. It's found throughout law. There's another period of time, 49 years, 50 years. That we find in law. Well, of course, we find that in the Bible because these ideas and concepts come out of the Bible. But we're warned not to make any covenants or leagues with the inhabitants. And of course, they're not talking about daily trades. They're talking about these binding agreements that live on over a long period of time. not just 7 years, but now you have to, for the rest of your life, anything you earn, you have to pay into this guy because he gave your children so-called free education. And I'm just using that as an example. That's not exactly the way it works, but that's the precept. If that was the agreement, then that would be the way it works. The agreement is a little bit different, but the precept is the same. In Revelation 15, verses 2 and 3, we see, "And I saw," and I'll abbreviate it a little bit here, "them that had gotten the victory over the beast and over the image and over his mark and over the number of his name. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb." So what is that song? Is that a particular melody? Is that so many verses of Amazing Grace? Is that the song of the Lamb? Is that the song of Moses? No, the song is the harmony of their way. That's what the song is. It's the righteousness of their way. And that creates a sort of harmony. And their harmony has to do, of course, with the perfect law of liberty and the right of choice. God gave us the right to choose. We should keep that right to choose always and hold it pressure. That is the highest power that God has given us, the right to choose. That is the liberty under God that we should all keep, that right to choose. If you enter into these leagues and agreements, you have made a choice. And often that choice takes away the right to choose. If you say, "I will give you whatever you think is fair, and you will take care of me the rest of my life and protect me," you have given up your right to choose what is fair. You have just said that he could give, he would determine what was fair, and he now has the right to judge. He has the power. And in essence, that's what people do. You remember in Egypt, the people were in bondage. It says, "But I will, for their sake, remember the covenant of their ancestors, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the heathen, that I might be their God, and I am the Lord." That's in Leviticus 26:45. What is he talking about? Coming out of Egypt, where he was their God. He had the right to judge them. They had the right to choose, to some degree, under his constitution, under his covenant, how they were going to abide in that covenant, how they were going to give charity, how they were going to give contributions to their government, which was basically composed of the Pharisees, and occasionally in time of war, they would pick leaders to lead them in battle. But it was a very localized choice. You chose. Even tithing was not a guaranteed 10%. Tithing was according to their service. Yes, it should be about 10% of what you make, about, I'm saying, because that's not the way it was actually calculated. But, you know, in rounding numbers, we'll say that it's generally speaking 10%. But the reason why is because there were 10 families in each congregation. And if each family gave 10% of what they produced to this individual, then that individual, on average, would receive about average of what everybody else in the congregation was making. And he would use that to support his family. Now, they don't just give it to him because he's got this little sticker on his chest that says Levite. He's serving the tents of the tabernacle, the congregations of the people through these 10 families. Tabernacles of the congregation, it says. Well, the tabernacles of the congregation is the tents or the homes of the congregation. He and his family are the ministers to those 10 families. He is dealing with governmental matters. The liturgy which he serves is literally public service. It was interesting to me in studying Greek that the word liturgy comes from a Greek word, basically liturgia, which means public service. That's right. The ministers, the priests, if you want to call them priests, were the public servants of the kingdom of God. They were the ministers to the people. There wasn't any other government, folks. There was no income tax. There was tithing. There was no, there was a sin contribution that you made, but you had to determine that. There was nobody to force that contribution. Over and over again in the Old Testament, they talk about free will offerings. It wasn't until they got Saul that they got the first forced offering to the government. And as soon as he did that, Samuel came in and said, "Your government's going to fail now. It's not going to last. You've been foolish." That's the word he called it. When you forced an offering to the people, you were foolish. And that's because you're going to destroy the very essence of God's kingdom, which is a government under the perfect law of liberty, where the right to choose, that higher power to choose, is constantly in the hands of the individual. Now, that means that if you want those rights given to you by God, you must exercise the responsibilities given to you by God. And you may find yourself paying more taxes in the kingdom of God than you would be required to pay in the kingdoms of the world, because Jesus said that your righteousness should exceed that of the world. But the point is, you have that right of choice. And that right of choice will give you the opportunity to say, "This minister is really a good guy. He is doing lots of good. He is really helping people. He is speaking the gospel. He is teaching the gospel. He is out there helping the people. And I'm going to support that." Well, in the world, you may elect somebody and you think 10 minutes later, he is a blooming idiot. He is leading the people to destruction. He is a raving maniac. And you want to say, "Well, I don't want to contribute to what he's doing. He's nuts." You don't have that choice anymore. You've given up that choice. You can try to elect somebody else, but you better get a majority to do so. But you've given him power to collect your contributions. You've joined up. You become a citizen entitled within his government. And his government exercises authority. So his government can kind of come down to you and say, "Okay, time to contribute." And if you don't contribute, he can throw you in jail. This is exactly what the Pharisees were doing. 78 BC, they made it a law that you had to contribute. If you didn't, they turned it over to the court and you were dragged into court. And you could be punished in lots of different ways if you did not contribute. That's not the way Moses set it up, but that's the way the Pharisees were doing it at the time of Christ. And Christ came to redeem the people from that error, from that snare that they had been captured in, where they had lost the right to choose. This is a common theme that is just completely ignored almost in modern churches. They don't preach that. They talk, "Oh, the kingdom's only spiritual. It's only within you. That, you know, it's not really here at hand. It's after you die, you get it. Right now, you're just okay. Just do what you're told, and you're okay. I'm okay. We're all okay. God loves us. Don't have to worry about anything." That's not what the first century church was doing. It's not what they were saying. It's not what Christ said. He said it's not everybody who says, "Lord, Lord," but he who does the will of the Father. So we have to learn the song of Moses and the song of the Lamb. And we have to sing that from our hearts, where the kingdom of heaven begins. That's where it begins, in your heart and in your mind. And how does it get in there? Well, God puts it in there. He writes his laws upon your hearts and upon your mind. That is the covenant. He told us in the Old Testament that would be the covenant. He told us in the New Testament that would be the covenant. You can read it in Hebrews. So that idea of writing that law upon our hearts and our minds, creating that kingdom first in our hearts and in our minds, should begin to manifest itself in reality out in the world all around us in everything we do. And when someone looks at us, they will say, "Ah, the fruits of his faith, the fruits of his belief is not to exercise authority one over the other, not to force people into subjection, but is a fruit of love, of patience, of charity, of hope, where we do the right thing and only hope that you do the right thing back. But we're going to do the right thing, though God may slay us." That's what Joshua, "Though God may slay me, I shall serve him." And that's what we need to have, that same attitude, that we are going to go the way of the Lord. Now, I've just painted a little bit of that picture. We need to paint a lot more of it, and we're going to look at a lot of different aspects of this as much as we can in the short time that we have allotted But God does consider these agreements that we make as binding. That's important to understand. Brethren, I speak after the manner of men, though it be but a man's covenant. Yet if it be confirmed, I mean sealed, no man disannulleth it or addeth thereto. That's in Galatians 3:15. We need to understand that when we have to make our yeses yes and our noes no. If we swear, we're even bound more. Not only are we bound by what we have sworn, but those under which we have sworn can force us to comply with our oaths. And of course, if they become corrupt, their force may become corrupt. But they have us. We've been snared. And we need to be guarding ourselves so that we are not snared. In Galatians 5:1, he goes on to say, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage." Well, how do you get entangled? Well, one way is contracts and covenants. Another way is to eat at the table of rulers. And we are not to do that because it will become a snare. It will bind us. If they are not binding, why does he warn us against making these agreements? Of course, he warns us because he wants us to remain free souls under God. "Thou shalt make no covenants with them nor with their gods." That word gods there, we use that as if that only refers to God in heaven or some spiritual demon or something like that. The word God, you look in your Strong's Concordance. In the Old Testament, God is Elohim. In the New Testament, is Theos. Everywhere those words show up, that's the two words basically that you're translating into the word God, or even into the word gods. It's just occasionally they make it small g and big g. And generally speaking, I assume that they're right, but I wouldn't guarantee it as to whether this should be a big g or a little g. But that is a judgment call on the part of the translators. But the point is, those gods, that word God, was commonly used both in the Old Testament and New Testament to refer to magistrates and judges. Why? Because they were the ruling judges of courts. They had the right to exercise authority within the jurisdiction of that court. And that's the way they operated. And we have to understand that when he's talking about we're not to make covenants with their gods, he is very well talking about these men who can become judges over you. And of course, that is often the case with contracts. If you sign a contract and it says the remedy is in equity in that contract, then it will be a judge of equity that determines whether or not you violated the terms of that contract. By the nature of that contract, by the terms of that contract, often nowadays, by the way it's written, you used to always say whether the remedy was at common law or in equity. But as time went on, you could just tell an equity-type contract by the nature and the structure of that contract. And you could also look at the status of the individual and tell, well, he doesn't have the status to sign a common law contract, so this must be a contract in equity, administrative law. And the terms, what are you using for exchange? Well, common law only allows you to use certain things as an exchange. If you're using someone else's promises to make the exchange, you've got another party in on the contract, and therefore you will have to go to his courts to resolve issues of that contract. It can seemingly get very complicated, and we'll go through it eventually, but that's not the focus here. The point is that these covenants that you make with them or with their gods includes with their judges, because, again, Strong's Concordance, these words were used every day in courts of law at the time of Christ to address judges. You would call them Elohim or Theos. And we'll show you that over and over again throughout the writings of the time, throughout the Bible, throughout references to the people who had the power to judge are called gods. And as a matter of fact, they're even still called Theos to this very day. And we'll show you that, but at another time. Let's stay on point here. Have we been warned that the table which will be set for us may be a trap and a snare? Yes, absolutely. Romans 11, verses 9 and 10 are referring to an earlier reference in the Old Testament by David. And it says, "And David saith, let their table be made a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened, that they may not see and bow down their back always. Remember, we are not to make covenants with, not to bow down, not to serve, not to sacrifice to these gods. But they're saying that a table may become a snare where we end up bowing down. To who? The ruling judges, the gods of these agreements that we make. And we do that by eating at these tables. Well, they're not just talking about, lunchtime. They're talking about what you're consuming, where you're finding the source for your sustenance or your provisions or your victuals or whatever you want to call it. We see also in Proverbs 23, when thou sittest and eat with a ruler, consider diligently what is before thee and put a knife to thy throat. If thou be a man given to appetite, be not desirous of his dainties, for they are deceitful meats. Now that's somewhat figurative, but they're not talking about dietary eating at a table with the President of the United States. They're talking about benefits. They're talking about eating what he has to offer you and consuming it, because in the consumption of what he gives you, you become sealed in the agreements that go along with those programs, those schemes, those programs of benefits, and you become snared. And you can't even get those benefits until you start signing things, agreeing to things, usually under penalty of perjury. And we see also in Proverbs 22:26, be not thou one of them that strikes hands. And he's talking about making agreements, or of them that are a surety for debt. Well, almost all governments supply these benefits on a debt basis. Yes, the money comes from your neighbors eventually to pay the debt, but they're all in debt, so that when you take the benefit, you become a surety for the debt of that institution, which was created by the covenants, agreements, contracts, constitutions of the society in which you live. From the beginning of the Bible to the end of the Bible, throughout Christ, he is talking about not making these agreements, not applying, praying for these benefits that come to you by the expense of your neighbor, and certainly not by the expense of debt. And he is warning you over and over again not to participate in that. And your modern ministers are, like they say in Malachi, but ye are departed out of the way. Ye have caused many to stumble at the law. Ye have corrupted the covenant of the Levi. And I want you to understand, people say, oh, well, we're not under the law. Well, you are under the law. You are under the law of the gods which you have chosen for yourself. In the Old Testament, there were 700 laws. How many laws are there in the country in which you live? Remember the Old Testament, 700 laws. That was a government, a nation, under God. Okay, you say you're a nation under God. How many laws do you have? 700? 7,000? 70,000? Yes, you are under the law, and you are under the law because you have made a covenant, a contract. You have eaten at the table, and it may have become a snare and has bound you back into a system which is not designed according to God. And we'll look at how that comes about, what that means in relationship to these agreements today, yesterday, and tomorrow. Until then, may peace be on your house, and God bless you.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.